Time to catch up with Zoe Harcombe, diet and obesity expert. Morning, Zoe.
Good morning, Bill.
Good to talk to you. You've been doing a world tour, haven't you?
Oh, my goodness. I've just been saying yes to too many invites, I think, actually. I get so many speaking invites, which is lovely.
Yeah.
I'm not complaining.
Oh.
But they've been all over the place this year, actually. They've been 8 hours behind and 3 hours ahead.
Crikey.
And one follows the other, and then you go back to the West Coast and London, Wales, in between, Ooh. Scotland. So, time for a little bit of a break now, I think. Try to get some more research done.
Good for you. Good for you. And today we're going to talk about a quite big topic some kind of misinformation, let's say, that goes around about it. And that is diabetes. And 14th of November is World Diabetes Day, so it's just gone. And you've done a couple of things where you've talked about it and also reviewed progress since the last World Diabetes Day. Can we start with the basics? Because it can be a bit confusing, diabetes. There's two types, aren't there? So what's it all about, diabetes?
Well, that's one of the interesting starting things, actually. There could be three types.
Ah.
So we're very, very familiar, or most people should be familiar, with type 1 and type 2.
Yeah.
Type 1, we don't fully understand. We're pretty sure it's an autoimmune condition. We think there's a genetic stroke, hereditary, part to it.
Ah.
But it's basically where the pancreas just stops producing insulin.
Okay.
So the person who develops type 1 needs to start taking insulin, basically.
Right.
But that has become more interesting because that used to be called childhood diabetes or juvenile diabetes.
Yeah.
Because if you didn't have it by 21, you probably weren't going to get it.
Okay.
But we're now seeing adults develop type 1. So the Prime Minister, former Prime Minister of the UK, Theresa May, developed type 1 diabetes,
Ooh.
I think in her 40s, if not 50s.
Wow.
So that one's pretty interesting. Type 2 used to be called maturity onset diabetes. That used to be the one that Granny got aged sort of 70, 80, just because she'd been eating humbugs and Battenberg cake and had a bit of a sweet tooth.
Right.
And basically too much sugar too often over a long period of time, and then it would be the sort of older person's disease. I think at the current stage, the youngest person that we've got in the world diagnosed with type 2 diabetes is 3.
Ah.
So we have toddlers developing what should be seen as a lifestyle illness.
And what does that manifest itself as in body terms, then, type 2 diabetes? What does it do?
Yeah, so type 2 diabetes, the easiest way I find to describe it, whereas you've got type 1, the pancreas just doesn't work at all,
yeah.
And it's a sort of malfunction within the body. Type 2, to me, can be best summarised by the body saying, enough is enough.
Uh-huh.
You have put too much carbohydrate into me too often. Every time you put carbohydrate into me, I need to deal with the glucose.
Right.
It used to happen a couple of times a day, or maybe I got one meal every 2 days. Now you put in something in every 5 minutes, and I've got to try and get the glucose out of the bloodstream. And I'm sorry, but I'm done. I'm packing up. I'm not working in the way that I should. And that's why so many people are getting type 2. So 95% of people have got type 2 diabetes, which is pretty much entirely avoidable and also possible to put into remission. Now, I'll just touch briefly on type 3.
Yeah.
Because back since about 2008 was the first paper that I saw on this, people are starting to talk about dementia and Alzheimer's as type 3 diabetes.
Oh.
So that they're saying effectively type 2 diabetes is the effect of too much carbohydrate, glucose on the body, and type 3 is the effect of too much carbohydrate and glucose on the brain, on the mind.
Ah, okay.
And the evidence I've seen for that is very, very plausible. And again, it would help to explain why we're having a massive increase in dementia and Alzheimer's and mind-related illness, and in younger people as well, which is quite surprising.
And for those who have the more common type 2 diabetes, then what happens in their lives? What do they have to do then?
Well, this is the crazy thing. So people will go into the GP and they'll go in reporting fatigue. They might have been urinating more frequently than usual because that's the body, the sugar ends up in the urine and the body is actually then trying to get rid of the sugar
right.
in the urine. The body is fabulously brilliant at dealing with all the rubbish that
yeah.
we do with it.
Yeah, thank God.
So they turn up at the doctors and they've got the classic symptoms. Sometimes they lose a bit of weight
uh-huh.
Because if your insulin is not working very well, then you're not packing fat away into fat cells. And quite often, of course, people don't go to the GP saying, oh, I'm losing weight, I'm quite pleased with this.
Right.
That is actually what happened to Theresa May. She did say in an interview, oh, I was quite pleased with the weight loss. I thought, oh, maybe I've just been watching my food better than I thought. But unexplained weight loss should get you into the GP, whether you're happy with it or not. Just get in. It's not a good sign.
Sure.
And then the doctor will probably do a quick urine test, first of all, takes 1 minute, and then follow that up with a blood test. And what they're looking for there is what they call the HbA1c, which is effectively the measure of how much glucose you've had in your blood over the last 3 months.
Right.
And that's the really powerful measure, because that's not recording the fact that you were out at a birthday party last night and you had a load of cake and you don't normally have that. It's reflecting the fact that over the last 3 months you've had too much sugar in your blood too often.
Okay.
And your body has now said, look, I can't deal with it anymore. You're now type 2 diabetic.
Okay, understood. The other words, which I wouldn't mind some explanation of, was glycemic and hypoglycemic. What's all that about?
Yeah, so as soon as you see glycemic, G-L-Y-C, start thinking glucose.
Right.
Because it is involved in the medical literature. It's effectively talking about glucose. So when people have hypo, always means low. So if you've got hypothyroidism, that means low thyroid.
Oh, I see.
And hyper always means high. If you
got
think
it.
Of a child, hyper, high.
Yep. Yep.
It's a good way to remember it. And so hypoglycemia means literally low blood glucose.
Mm-hmm.
And hyperglycemia means literally high blood glucose.
Right.
And you can see that in children. Give children some sweets, and you can immediately see them go into a hyperglucose state.
Yes.
And the problem with diabetes is that what we try to do with the body, the body, remember, only has 1 teaspoon of glucose in the entire bloodstream at any one time. I probably shouldn't say remember, because not everybody knows that.
Mm.
1 teaspoon of glucose, 4 grams. So the minute you have even a medium apple, you've probably put in 3 times the glucose into the bloodstream that the body was able to handle.
Wow.
And the body then has to deal with it and get it out of the bloodstream. So at the moment that you've eaten the apple, believe it or not, let alone that even a bag of sweets, you are in a state of hyperglycemia,
yes,
which in normal people without diabetes, the body will handle. But what often happens, because the body tries to be perfect, but it's not quite perfect. So, and particularly with things that are foreign, and now not an apple, but let's say you did have a big bag of sweets.
Yeah.
The body has just not evolved to recognize that, to deal with it, to cope with it. We can eat a bag of sweets and put 50 grams of glucose straight into the bloodstream. I mean, you are talking body crisis meltdown emergency 999,
wow,
as far as the body is concerned. And the body then tries to get it out of the bloodstream. And sometimes, quite often, in fact, it will do it just a little bit too well. So you will actually end up with lower blood glucose than you had before you ate the bag of sweets.
Oh. What in the body is working hard to do that, Zoe? Which bit of the body is in charge of the crisis?
Okay, so it's the pancreas.
Okay.
So the pancreas, the 2 key hormones, there's a lot of hormones going on in the whole hormonal system, but the 2 key hormones in the pancreas that regulate our blood sugar levels are called insulin and glucagon.
Right.
And if we put glucose into the bloodstream, so we have a slice of bread,
yep,
then insulin is called upon to take that glucose out of the bloodstream and go and store it away as stored glucose. And the name
right.
of stored glucose is glycogen. Now, when we have low blood glucose, and this actually happens, or it should happen to most people in the early hours of the morning, about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, if you're not stuffing your face with carbohydrates all day long, you should actually get to the point that you're a little bit low in blood glucose.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've actually used up your stored glucose overnight, just resting and moving around in bed or whatever, and that's when the body will wake up glucagon and say, okay, go and put a bit of glucose back into the bloodstream.
Right.
And you're talking about a gram, and then you're back in the normal range.
I see.
That's how sensitive these 2 hormones are. And of course, the most they've had to deal with for 3 million years or whatever in us and our ancestors has been berries. You know, we stumble
yes.
upon some berries.
Yeah.
Fruit is a much more recent thing. Yes, there would have been apples and pears and stuff around sort of from medieval times, but not the apples that we've engineered today to be 10 times sweeter than is natural.
And what about, so if somebody is hyperglycemic, in other words, their blood glucose is very high, is this the case where doctors would then administer insulin by injection, or have I got that wrong?
No, you're right. So with a type 1, where the body can't produce insulin to counter that hyper situation, you can administer insulin. My brother's a type 1 diabetic, so we were trained in this many years ago. And we were trained to recognise the difference between a hypo and a hyper. So if my brother's hyper, he seems like a drunk person.
Really?
So, yeah, he's really... a bit off his head, a bit sort of gregarious, bolshy kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you suddenly realise he's got too much blood sugar.
Yeah.
Now, you can administer insulin. The best thing would probably be just to let him burn it off, because the body will burn off sugar.
Right.
So if somebody realises that they've had too much sugar and doesn't want to put in more insulin, then they might just go out for a little walk or go out for a run. That's not the most dangerous situation for a type 1. It's dangerous to any human to have too high sugar for too long.
Right.
That's what ends up doing the damage that really is serious with diabetes. So when you see people losing their limbs or losing their eyesight, that's, there are 130 amputations, is it a week or something? Or I know a surgeon who used to do hip and knee operations, and now all he does is chop limbs off diabetic people down in Australia.
God.
So there's two things that a type 1 will most fear. One is if they don't manage to keep their glucose low over time, so to get their own HbA1c down, then sugar damages the body. It damages the eyes, it damages the limbs, it damages the extremities. And you get to the point that effectively the cells just die.
Oh,
and the foot goes gangrenous and it needs amputating.
Wow.
The more immediate fear of a type 1, and it's pretty unique to a type 1, is the hypo.
Yep.
And actually that's the one, if you ever hear, and it's rare, thankfully,
right.
But if you ever hear of a type 1 who's actually died, gone into a coma and died, that's a hypo.
Right. Low
and
blood glucose.
That's when they had low blood glucose. They basically took too much insulin for the carbohydrate meal. My brother did this one day, actually. I was with him, and he would inject insulin before a meal because you want to get the body ready to sort out the glucose when it comes in.
I see, yeah.
But then we didn't have a very high-carb meal. He'd actually cooked the meal, but he kind of miscalculated how many carbs he was going to have. So he'd put in a lot of insulin, but then didn't eat many carbs.
Oh.
And we sat down to watch a movie. And so over that two-hour period, we didn't realize that he was getting lower and lower and lower in blood glucose. And we got to the end of the movie, and his girlfriend said, "Are you going to walk Zoe home?" And he said, "Yeah," and just sat there. And she said, "Well, go on then." And he just sat there. He didn't know what home was. He didn't know what I was. He didn't know what walking was. He didn't know what his shoes were. He just looked at us. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
And all we had to do was to get some sugar. So we got some orange juice out of the fridge and tried to shove it in his mouth. And you only need to get a tiny... I mean, he's obviously fighting us. You only need to wet his lips and you've got enough sugar going into the bloodstream.
Incredible.
Suddenly he's as right as rain again.
Incredible.
It's unbelievable.
Now, I remember my dear late mother, after she'd had a heart attack, she became diabetic, and apparently that's quite common, and she would then become obsessed with the little machine that people get and take blood samples from your finger. Is that what diabetics need to be doing then, regularly?
Do you know, that's so interesting. There are people at the conferences I've been to recently, there are people who think that diabetes precedes heart disease.
Uh-huh.
So my suspicion with your mother, and certainly the suspicion of a number of speakers in this field, particularly people like Ivor Cummins, Dr. Jeffrey Gerber, the work of Joseph Kraft, they would basically say that your mother was diabetic and was undiagnosed.
How interesting.
And then had a heart attack. Because,
how
of course, the sugar in the bloodstream is damaging the endothelial wall. It's damaging the lining of the artery.
Right.
Which is, we've had debates before about cholesterol and statins and all the rest of it. It's like, it's not the cholesterol. The cholesterol goes to repair the damage.
Yeah.
The thing that's causing the damage, sugar is among one of the things. Smoking will be another. Stress will be another. there'll be chemicals that we ingest that do damage.
Yeah.
But my suspicion with your mother would be that she's had diabetes for quite some time, being damaged all the way through the bloodstream lining of the arteries.
Yeah.
And then damage upon damage, because she carried on eating. Presumably she had a bit of a sweet tooth and enjoyed carbohydrates and sweet things.
Scottish, I think it's kind of mandatory for Scots to be like that, I think. I think it's a national a national disease, to be honest with you.
Yeah, the deep fried Mars bar or whatever. So we were touching on earlier, when you get diagnosed, so when you turn up at the GP surgery and you've either just been diagnosed, most likely 9.5 times out of 10 with type 2, more rarely with type 1, in my opinion, what should then happen is the doctor should explain what we've just been talking about and say, essentially, diabetes is the inability to handle glucose.
Yeah.
It's either the complete inability, type 1, or it's the acquired inability, type 2, but essentially you can no longer handle glucose.
Right.
So, of course, what should the dietary advice be? Avoid glucose.
Hmm.
But what is the dietary advice? The dietary advice is the standard low-fat, high-carb dietary advice. And every carbohydrate delivers glucose to the body. Mm. It might deliver something else. So fruit, for example, will deliver fructose and glucose.
Yeah.
Milk is quite sweet. If you don't eat sweet stuff, milk is lovely and sweet. And milk will deliver glucose and something called galactose.
Right.
But every carbohydrate, rice will be delivering glucose.
Mm-hmm.
Bread, glucose, sweets, glucose, obviously everything at some level. Every carbohydrate is delivering glucose. And yet they still tell diabetics, base your meals on starchy foods.
Wow. And in fact, this is part of your second article that you have on your website, which is basically saying that the UK, post-World Diabetes Day, continues to get the Luddite Award because they give exactly the wrong advice, basically.
Oh, it's just terrible. I mean, it's just terrible. They do have conflicts. So they have conflicts with the pharmaceutical companies and with fake food companies. So arguably, Diabetes UK are maintaining their own interests, keeping their sponsors happy.
Yeah.
Their goal should be to make themselves redundant.
Yes.
Or
yes.
to make themselves a very small charity that has to deal with type 1 only.
Mm.
And properly manage why type 1 needs a charity, I don't know. Maybe for research or something.
Mm.
But then you don't need a charity to do research. The government should be giving money to brilliant researchers to find out what we don't know about type 1 diabetes. So They shouldn't exist, in my view, and they absolutely should not be giving out this high-carb advice, which they are. I got an email forwarded from a friend recently who's on their mailing list, and it was how to make Chelsea buns.
Right.
And these Chelsea buns were tiny, and they had 28 grams of carbohydrate each.
Oh, goodness.
Now, the doctors presenting at the conferences where I'm at will be advising diabetics of either type not to exceed 30 grams of carbohydrate a day.
Mm.
So Diabetes UK are quite happy to give you your daily allowance, shall we call it, of carbohydrate in one Chelsea bun.
Goodness.
And worse, they even said, oh, this will be a lovely pick-me-up in the afternoon. Like, stop snacking, stop telling them to eat between meals.
That's incredible.
It's unbelievable.
And you note in your article that the UK are particularly bad. The US actually got the award for the most progress since the last World Diabetes Day, which just surprised me, I've got to say.
Oh, no, the US has actually really come along, and I actually think it might be down to someone who I've also met at conferences. There's a huge value to conferences. A dietitian called Laura Saslow.
Uh-huh.
And Laura managed to get onto the diabetes review team, and I can only think that she has had an absolutely enormous impact.
Good for her.
Because it was a seismic shift in the US position, practically embracing low-carb diets, to be honest. I mean, one of their new messages that came out, choose whole, unprocessed foods over processed foods. I mean, that's what we're always saying in these chats, Bill. Eat real food.
Yeah.
But then their second bit of advice, unbelievable, eat non-starchy vegetables.
Mm.
So even vegetables, they were saying, guys, don't be approaching vegetables with a free range. You really want to be limiting the starchy ones, which would be essentially root vegetables, obviously potatoes, turnips, parsnips, carrots, swede, those kind of things. Avoid even those. I mean, that's unbelievable advice.
Mm.
So the US have really made a bit of progress. UK, sadly not so.
Oh, dear. So, for the average person now listening to this, I mean, I get blood tests regularly. What would we be looking for? I mean, we shouldn't be looking for anything because the doctor should be telling us, but that's a whole other story. What should we be looking for in a blood test, let's say? Is it a number for glucose? Is that it?
Yeah, so you can get a number of different measures done, and the MOTs probably would do them.
Yeah.
If you went into the GP with a specific complaint,
yes,
they might go looking for them, but they might not necessarily go looking for them.
Right.
And you've got all different kinds of measures. So you've got the sort of MMOL per L, and you'd be looking at something certainly below 6. There's a percentage that you can get for the HbA1c, and you'd be looking for something below 48. But whenever you get blood tests, there's a normal range that is shown.
Yes.
And then it's not just, oh, I want to be below that magic number.
Mm.
If you can be, for things like blood glucose, you want to be at the lower end of
yes.
normal.
Yeah.
You don't want to be creeping up towards
sure.
what we would call pre-diabetic and then into the diabetic range.
And do the machines, the little machines that prick your finger and do a result, are they good? Are they accurate or worth having?
They're okay, but they have been effectively replaced. We've had a bit of a revolution in diabetes over the last few years. So we've now got something that we call a continuous glucose monitor.
Yes.
Because the trouble with the finger prick is your mum will have found them. First of all, you have to do it so many times
sure.
a day to get a picture. Your fingers start going numb.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's not very nice. And it just gives you that absolute instant moment.
Yeah.
And that could be, you could be in the progress of getting sugar out of the bloodstream,
yeah.
or it could have just
a
gone
spike
in.
Spike or something, yeah.
You
yeah.
don't really know. So these new things called continuous glucose monitors, my husband and I actually got hold of one.
Yes.
And there's quite a few non-diabetics trying this as well because it's just fascinating. It's quite expensive.
Right.
Because you've first of all got to get hold of the delivery mechanism, and they're like gold dust, or they certainly were last summer. They were running out all over the place.
Mm.
But they're about £150. And then for one little disc, you might have seen some people with a little disc on the back of their arm.
Yeah.
Theresa May, again, used to wear them quite openly when she was at sort of black tie do's, and she'd wear a dress and show off her CGM, as
yeah.
they're called. And you can get one of those from the chemist for about £50, but that only then lasts a fortnight. So we got the machine from someone who worked in the field of diabetes, which was very kind, and then hubby and I bought one of the discs.
Yeah.
And you whack it onto the back of your arm, and it's basically measuring your glucose continuously
yeah.
over the two-week period.
Right.
So you can see exactly when you've had your breakfast. So my husband would have bacon and egg for breakfast. Absolutely nothing would
right.
happen to his blood glucose level because he's not put any glucose into his bloodstream.
Right.
Kelsey-pre. So my yep. breakfast is more typically full-fat milk, full-fat yogurt, some
yeah.
berries. And that doesn't do too much because berries are quite low sugar.
Mm-hmm.
But then I would have an orange and my blood glucose would spike.
Wow.
It's just incredible. It would just spike out of the normal range.
Yeah, I saw the pictures you put
I'm
on your
not,
website of this. It's quite extraordinary
yeah,
how much. Yeah,
it is actually. Yeah, and because I'm not diabetic, it would then spike down
yeah.
quite quickly. But the one that we tried that we were the most interested in, both of us, we had what diabetics are advised to have for breakfast, which would be a healthy bowl of porridge.
Right.
And we'd have some porridge oats and some milk with that. And the only way I can describe it is it looks like Table Mountain.
Yes, I'm looking at
South
it, yeah.
South Africa. So it goes up and then it flattens out at a sort of plateau at the top and then it goes down. But that's over about a 2 to 3 hour period.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
you come to the conclusion that these so-called slow-release carbohydrates, I mean, all they do is mess up your blood glucose for longer.
Goodness.
You're actually probably better with the fast-release ones. Get it in, deal with it, get it out.
Yeah, yeah.
But, of course, what we're doing is having slow-release for breakfast and then an apple mid-morning, so then we spike on top of the slow-release,
mm.
and then a sandwich for lunch, so we're back to a big plateau, and then a piece of fruit or a tea cake in the afternoon, and we spike it again, and then pasta or potatoes or rice, all the things we're told to eat for dinner. And no wonder, we're making type 2 diabetics by the day.
Extraordinary. A last final thing, we had a WhatsApp from one of our listeners who says, is it okay to use stevia instead of sugar, and which fruit has the most sugar?
I'll take the second question first. So the tropical fruits have the most sugar.
Oh.
So if you're thinking pineapples, Watermelons. I mean, if you ever have watermelon,
really?
And then look at the plate after a watermelon. You can actually see the granules of sugar on the plate amongst the liquid. Yeah, so mangoes, just tropical stuff, bananas. Tropical stuff is not so good. The fruit that has the least is berries.
Yeah.
And then you've got lower sugar fruits, and that would be things like apples and pears, particularly ones that are in the natural environment.
Right.
So at the moment, we're still getting some English apples, English pears, and we get them from the organic man, and I bite into them, and it's like someone has just put a lemon in my mouth. They are so sharp. They are not sweet,
right.
and they're not like an American Red Delicious. Stevia is interesting. I mean, stevia is a sweetener. There are many sweeteners.
Yeah.
I think stevia is one of the caloric sweeteners from memory. I'm not so good with sweeteners because I just don't use the things.
Yeah.
If any calories are going into the body, then that is going to be a sweetness that the body
right.
needs to get out. So caloric sweeteners will have a similar impact to just sticking sugar in, table
right.
sugar, just perhaps a slightly modified impact, because they do tend to have fewer calories than sugar. Even the calorie-free sweeteners, things like aspartame, there have been studies that show that the body doesn't ignore them. It doesn't respond to them quite the same as it does sugar, but it responds at some level. So
right.
it's as if the body is not only detecting the glucose that's gone into the bloodstream, but we have receptors that detect sweetness.
Okay.
Because that will be the body's way of starting to prepare the pancreas for you need to start dealing with this sugary thing that's coming in.
Understood.
And we start dealing with carbohydrates in the digestive process. We deal with those in the mouth. So we actually have salivary enzymes all over our mouth. And if you put some sugar, just a sugar cube, in your mouth, the salivary enzymes start breaking down that carbohydrate immediately before it goes down through the digestive system. But that is almost certainly one of the ways in which the body signals, okay, something sweet has come in, get ready, pancreas, to
right.
start dealing with this.
How interesting. Zoe, as always, what can I say? You've just put it so well. We've gone on a long time, but I think it's worth doing because this is something that is a growing problem for a lot of people. And your explanation has always been brilliant. There's a lot more on your website on this and some of those diagrams I was referring to about when you tried the continuous glucose monitor, which are really interesting to have a look at. ZoeHarcombe.com. Is the website, is it not?
Can I just, can I just say one thing
yeah,
before we go? Because
sure.
that's the only thing we didn't touch on.
Yeah.
And this has got to be a really positive message for people out there, is that type 2 can be put into remission.
Yes.
I don't like using the word reversal, because you will always have type 2. If you go back to eating the way that you did to get it, you will get type 2 again.
Right.
But you can eat in such a way, either with a very low calorie diet, which I don't think is sustainable, or with a very low carb diet, which I do think is sustainable. So investigate if you've got type 2 diabetes and you don't want the long-term consequences and you don't want to be on meds for the rest of your life, you can do something about it.
As so Michael Jackson said, make that change.
Do it indeed.
Zoe, brilliant. Jack. Lovely to talk to you. Have a nice weekend and hope you get a bit more relaxing done.
Brilliant, and you.
Take
Cheers,
care.
Bill.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.